It's fantastic that Diana Quick is here today. We know her for your work from theatre, television, film and so on, but in particular it's important because of Diana's affinity with Jean Rhys and Phyllis Awfrey, which is really unique and special, and we appreciate it, us Awfrey Rhys fans. Especially the people who saw After Mrs. Rochester, the amazingly innovative play in which Diana played Jean Rhys. Did it at all?
Half of Jean Rhys.
Did, yes.
I
did it
the older,
the
Jean,
older
Rhys,
Jean Rhys.
Somebody else did the younger.
Right.
Jean.
Did it tour?
It toured for about 3 months, and then it went into the West End for 6 months.
Yes, that's where I saw it. Yes,
yeah.
But it didn't go to the States. Or
not yet, although there is a fantasy which may
right.
become a reality. It was done by a company which you may,
yes.
if you didn't see that production, you may know shared experience.
Yes.
Sadly, I've had
it's
a tough
no
time,
longer.
So they've lost their Arts Council funding. But they're a company who do a lot of collaborative work and who have, in particular, one of their writer directors, Polly Teal, has concerned herself with reanimating a lot of classic novels, sometimes in collaboration with other writers. And she has done a big project on Jane Eyre, and she has a fantasy of reviving her Jane Eyre production and After Mrs. Rochester and playing them back to back at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. So. That may or may not.
That would be great.
Don't hold your breath.
Right. And before that, as Madame in the Orchid House, of which we're going to see a few extracts afterwards, and Diana says that she will talk a little bit about what it was like in the production, but only after she's seen the extracts.
Because
it was
so long.
It was a long time.
Although, actually, I do still have
right.
connections with Don Egan,
yes,
because
yeah.
If that going to do the Orchid House
yes.
was the first time I was there, and I very much fell in love with the island.
And you went back.
And I've been back.
Yes.
Yeah. I think
yes.
I've been back twice.
Yes.
And
come again.
Any day
right.
I'll come. And my sister came. Oh, well, I'll tell you that story.
Right. Okay. So, but before we see the film extracts. We're going to hear two of the short stories, Breeze and O Stayin' Here, and Denise is just going to say
two sentences
about each.
Okay.
Just to...
Okay.
Which one, which order?
Okay, so I talked a little bit about O Stayin' Here. I don't know that I can say a lot more about it right now, except to say that I think it's a really interesting story, and I'm sure you're going to do a fantastic reading of it.
Well, don't say that, because then they'll be
disappointed.
I'll do a sort of impression. O Stayin' Here. They are walking in the flower garden. And what are they singing? Something rather merry and mocking. The veering breeze blows up a few words now and then to the ears of a lady behind green bathroom blinds. Now the lady raises a long pale arm and applies a little soap to it, at the same time peeping through the slats without rising from her cool bathwater. Ce midi après-midi, Madame la tombée malade, voyez chercher la belle. The brown girl's arms are intertwined like snakes. Yet somehow the plump hand of Melfa, who is a maid by profession and fond of arranging flowers, reaches out with a sharp carving knife and lops off half a bush of crimson roses between one stanza and another. Both girls dip in a flying curtsy, and the thinner fingers of Ariadne, the 18-year-old cook, brush grass and come up with the dazzling spray. Monsieur l'abbé, venez, il dit, Rome, saeculorum, Madame la compensaeum. But I thought they said the patois was common and that they disdained it, says this English Madame La to herself, standing on a rush mat and dabbing off a rivulet absently. To think of me myself, indulging in a cold bath at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she comments inwardly. When she told them about the sudden dinner, they had taken it very sweetly. A business friend of the master's. Oh, yes, mistress, understood. He is a director but has quite a simple appetite. Flying fish, says Ariadne, and fried plantains, adds Melfa. Oh, no, I think not fried plantains. Too hot. Something green, perhaps a little stuffed avocado? Stuffed with what, mistress? Asks Ariadne bluntly. Oh, I don't know, perhaps some parsley? The hen and the reading boy have taken the parsley, Melfa says. Well, then, I leave it to you. They're pleased. They like things being left to them. They take out the carving knife and go out into the garden. But instead of hunting for a last blade of parsley or a handful of chives, they dance around in the high, soft breeze, lopping off roses. Their aprons lift and swirl, and they look like ballet dancers dressed as probationer nurses. The full skirts of their uniforms are covered with a flight of multicolored wild ducks. Their little song has come to an end, so they begin it again. Samedi après-midi, Madame la tombe malade. It's Saturday afternoon, and if I had fainted in my bath, I could have drowned. I could have died, and those girls wouldn't have been in the least concerned, thinks Madame la, anxiously. She's envious of them, because they have each other for gay company. Now they are advancing on the lonely house, using their bouquet to shoo before them a brown hen with well-clipped wings. This is the pullet which had the temerity in the middle of a sweltering West Indian summer to lay one egg in a secret place and hatch out a solitary cream-coloured chicken. The girls drive the hen cups the chick with her shortened wings, all rushing and giggling, clucking posse towards the kitchen steps, under which the hen and chicken disappear. Something about the hen and chick has a secret colour of mirth over the girls. They sit on the bottom step, laps full of roses and arms round each other's necks, laughing fecklessly. Madame La has her own method of attracting attention. She leans out of the window with a small brass bell suspended on a string and tinkles it above the white-capped heads. Melta, Ah, yeah, you don't forget Mr. Whitmer is coming to dinner.
Yes, mistress, says Melta in her deep, harsh contralto. We forget ourselves, the hen makes us laugh. But they are speaking to an empty window. Madame La has slipped downstairs to greet them on the landing. She wants to know what there is about the hen. About the hen? Ariadne starts to laugh again. It's really intolerable. At last, Melta says, it is the hen and her child. The hen and her child is like ourselves, says Ariadne, rising to full copper height. Melta is engaged in slicing off the rose stems, for all the world as if she was going to stuff Mr. Whitmer's avocado pears with the trimmings. Madame La notices how pretty both girls are, and that Ariadne is the one with the crisp, scornful upper lip. She takes pride in her cheek, which is of a lighter complexion than herself, volunteers Melta. Just as we do, says Ariadne. They both laugh again to see the amazement and appeal on Madame La's face. It's giving them great pleasure to satisfy her curiosity tormentingly, bit by bit. I have a daughter of very pale coloration, says Ariadne. It is a girl. She is named Dolores. I also have a child, a boy named Arbuthnot. He is even so light as Adonis' child and born in the same month, says Melta. And how old are these children? Asks Madame La, sounding lost. When she says the word children, she looks wonderingly at their continuing childish arabesque against a background of roses. 2 years at Epiphany, says Melta, and Ariadne echoes, Epiphany. And where are they? Where? Ask the girls together, astonished. With our mothers in the country, mistress, naturally. Ariadne declares, we were raised up as neighbours. We do everything together. Madame La makes an effort and collects herself. You must bring the children to see me. Yes, mistress. They undulate evasively. But don't forget the dinner. Perhaps I could arrange the roses to save time. Melta lays down the stems reproachfully. To create a diversion, Ariadne exclaims with cunning, I can hear the master's step, mistress. So Madame La goes back upstairs and finds that Rodney indeed stands steaming with recent energetic action on the upstairs veranda. A strange redness overlays his sun-brown face. Have you been playing tennis? She asks him. No, darling, says Rodney, turning his back to reveal that his shirt is torn to shreds. I've been fighting. All her life, she has been wanting Rodney to be successful and masterful, and now she is not sure that success really suits him. Is he, after all, getting too tough? With the skipper of the Douce Hélène, answers her question tersely. Oh, Rodney, that poor black man. He nearly made me £2,000 poorer by tipping our new engine into the sea. I had practically to stun him to get it eased back into the boat until we could land it. She is silent, envisaging the horrid scene, a large lump of tangled steel perilously rocking, and Rodney springing at the skipper's gleaming torso. But Rodney appears unconcerned. He removes his shredded shirt and makes for the bathroom. To soothe him further, she calls through the netted swing door. I have a theory about the social aspects of... That Rodney calls back. Oh, Lord, no theory, not with Whitmer coming to dinner. She's hurt because really her theory is quite delicate and distinguished. She believes now that people in this tropical island do not make love for romantic reasons, but as social and evolutionary means. She's thinking of Melta and Ariadne and their children of light coloration and the hen and the chick. It all seems to link up. Fastening her pearls above the surf green voile, she sighs, and then she begins to hum the catchy little song the girls were singing in the garden, going downstairs a moment later to see how Mr. Whitmer's dinner is progressing. If there is any dinner at all, it must be incarcerated in the frightening iron oven. Even the open coal pot has disappeared. So have the girls. Madame La runs back upstairs in distress. Rodney, I can't find the maids and the coal pot is gone too. She hunts for her little brass bell. Don't worry, he says. They're probably ironing out each other's hair with flat irons. They always do before a dinner party. Look out of the back window and you'll see them at it.
He's quite right. Ariadne is stretched on a piece of sacking outside the maid's room. Melter is applying a sizzling iron to her short, crimped hair, pulling as she presses. It's a painful scene, like an operation, and is transforming the girl into a sophisticated arrower.
"And I can't think," cries Madame La, "why they should want to have hair as straight as ours when they mock at us so."
Rodney laughs. He goes to a cabinet and pours out two long frosted drinks to fortify them against their guest.
Yet after all, the evening turns out smooth and gracious.
Mr. Whitbread does most of the talking. As Rodney has hinted, he is a man of theories. He's a much travelled man and makes a good story of how he found an almost untarnished button of his glorious regiment on a high slope in the Himalayas. Once too, he entered an African chieftain's hut and was surprised to see the pennant of his yacht club fluttering above a four-poster.
Fluttering?
Madame cannot resist exclaiming, thinking of the draft on the dying chieftain, she having imagined African huts as windowless as igloos.
But not the least charming of my adventures, says Mr. Whitborough over the crimson roses.
He's quite handsome for his age, and his quivering nostrils seem to devour the flying fish before he lifts his fork. After all, the dinner is superb, though it seems to have been cooked in 10 minutes, and the mysterious stuffing which inflates the yellow-green avocado pears must always remain a secret.
When I visited this island once, not so awfully long ago, my friend Arbuthnot and I went up the Riviere Fantasque. He was trying to net rare birds for his tropical aviary, and I was after edible crabs. We sat there on the riverbank, enjoying the scene and contemplating a plunge, when suddenly, the memory is so sweet, so inconquerable, that Mr. Whitbread's nostrils meet his upper lip with an unusual smile. Suddenly there was this voice coming from the depths of what I can only describe as a jungle, and we saw that higher up the river, two comely girls, clothed only in a series of patches, were beating some cloth against a rock in the water and singing. At least one of them was singing, and I'm sure you will never guess what the words were. "A song about a sick lady on Saturday afternoon," Madame La puts forward, startling Rodney by her sudden vivacity. She has taken advantage of Melter's absence with the empty plates, but she knows, she is positive, that behind the glazed screen, two interlinked forms are panting against each other with suppressed giggles. Mr. Whitcross stares at Madame La in astonishment. "And how the abbé was called in," she starts to explain.
Oh, no, Mr. Whitbread states firmly, authoritatively. "No, nothing as ribald as that. Something very strange, almost, one might say. Moving. A Shakespearean song to an Elizabethan air. We distinctly heard it. Oh, stay and hear, your true love's coming." And the other voice took it up. "That can sing both high and low." I remember how it echoed down the valley. Both high and low. It quite put poor Arbuthnot off his game. He dropped the net and three rare specimens escaped.
"Oh, that's a beautiful tale, Whitbread. One of your best," says Rodney.
"And the most beautiful thing is that it's quite true," says Mr. Whitbread.
"I believe it," says Madame La, sparkling.
"But surely that's not the end of it," says Rodney.
"Ah, my dear fellow," says Mr. Whitbread. "I have learned by long experience as a raconteur that there is a point at which one ends a story. That little tale has an element of pure, unexpected romance. To carry it further, we could croon."
"Since you press me, Arbuthnot went up the river after his birds, or after the girls, I don't know which.
And did you ever find any edible crabs?" asks Madame La, borrowing an inflection of mockery from somewhere.
She does not expect Mr. Whitbread to reply. Besides, Melter has just come in with a crystal bowl full of fruit jelly. The night is so hot that the bright rainbow-coloured mound wobbles dangerously on the brink of disintegration. It looks as if it is shaking, shaking with secret laughter.
Brilliant.
But brilliantly read is what I mean. The second story that Diana's going to read for us is Breeze, which I think is similarly interesting for different reasons, but similarly kind of ambiguous and full of desire and creolizing possibilities. So thank you. Breeze.
Breeze. I was stretched out on a mat under the impenetrable mango tree in the back garden, sucking pear drops and reading a very old copy of Tidy Tim's Weekly, but I had been told not to show myself at the front gates. Although innocent of any design on the reputation of the white official class, I was in disgrace. My great uncle, the colony's medical officer, had issued a statement to the press that the prevalent epidemic was Kaffir pox, a disease that was unlikely to affect people of pure European blood. Unfortunately, the first white victim of this unpleasant ailment was the Anglican Archdeacon, and the second was myself, then a child of 10. My nurse, finding me on that morning fretful and convalescent, had bribed me to stay out of sight under the mango tree by giving me a bag of sweets and making many promises which I knew she wouldn't keep. My spotty face was spellbound over the English comic strips, and every now and then I would break one of my nurse's don'ts and scratch my legs with the hand that turned the pages and brushed away flies. I must have been there for over half an hour before a heavy rustling in the boughs above me made me conscious that something larger than bird or animal was about to slide to the ground. It was Breeze. Breeze, the wild girl, the notorious creature, who had been studying me in silence, but couldn't bear to see the last pear drops vanish into my listless mouth. Leaping down like a panther, Breeze grabbed the bag, and then a pear drop bulging out of her cheek greeted me. "Hello, skinny, got the Kaffir pox?" Although I had never met Breeze before and only seen her once in the distance being chased by a policeman, I knew who she was and a great deal about her. She was the girl who had no home, who lived wild, who was only 14 but had been to jail 5 times, who stole, who wore no clothes or at most one garment. Yes, she looked exactly the way the elders said she did. Crispy hair shaved, face hard and saucy and merry, and as if to demonstrate those legs which were as fleet as the wind and which had inspired her name, Breeze vaulted up into the branches again, her shapeless grey garment flapping. "Oh, do you live in our mango tree, Breeze?" I exclaimed in admiration, ignoring Breeze's insulting behaviour, for having attained a high branch, she leaned down grinning like the Cheshire Cat and calling out just loud enough for me to hear, "Skinny, skinny, poxy, poxy." After a while, I became irritated by these epithets and muttered back, "Jailbird, jailbird, naked jailbird. Like to see me naked? Like to see how I get out of this dress when they chase me?" asked Breeze, and I nodded avidly. She slid down the trunk of the mango tree again, and with a single wriggle of her bronze shoulders, disposed of the shapeless sack, which had a large neck opening and no buttons. She stood there before me in maidenly magnificence, and as if the sight of her was not sufficient to shame my puny child limbs, she remarked, "Wouldn't call me skinny, would you? That's my town clothes. When I live in forest, I live free." I gazed at her enviously. To live free. Wasn't that what every child desired? Not to be fretted on hot days by starched muslin dresses and cotton bloomers. To sleep in trees like a bird, and to be as beautiful a series of round shapes as Breeze, who was what the elders called ominously a big girl now. "Wished I could be you, Breeze," I complained. But Breeze said, surprisingly, "Rather be skinny. Don't run so fast now I'm grown. They'd catch me, wanted to put me to school, want me to live on cooked food, want to put me to work." "Listen, skinny," she bent down and glared at me terrifyingly, her brown shining face very near. know what the police want me to be? Want me to be a bucket lady. Now, although I was only 10, I knew well that to be a bucket lady was to pursue one of the two most ignominious professions in the colony, the other being designated huckster, and having something or other to do with meeting ships and trading with sailors. A bucket lady, I said aghast, breezed to empty our privy pail for 1 6 pence a week or worse, the privy pail of some family of lower social standing, Breeze having to walk carefully with a stinking bucket poised on her turban, sneaking down the lesser streets where no white people lived towards the sea dump on dark nights. Don't ever let them catch you and make you a bucket lady, Breeze. Oh, sorry, wrong person. Don't ever let them catch you and make you a bucket lady, Breeze, I cried. Oh, I don't mind smells. I sleep in closets on rainy nights, said Breeze proudly. But I mind walking slow and not living free. I mind doing same things every week. Hey, what you got on your arm, Poxy? She exclaimed, seizing the wrist on which the tight little gold coiled bracelet, a gift from my great uncle when I was 5, clung like a permanent handcuff. Gold! Real gold! Cried Breeze, her eyes greedy for the yellow shining thing. Give me that! Make me lovely earrings. I got pierced ears. Give me or I'll take it. And as I crouched away from her, not knowing whether to cry or to comply, Breeze made a nearer tiger leap and snarled in my ear, You kid! Take it off or I'll bite it off. While I huddled, petrified and fascinated, she added, And I'll bite your hand too. Hastily, I tugged at the bracelet, trying to part its two thick gold knobs with my left hand. Fortunately, I'd grown so thin that it came away suddenly, leaving red marks on my wrist. It rolled on the grass, and Breeze picked it up and put it in her mouth, where it gleamed like a bit between her ferociously beautiful teeth. I began to howl with rage and loss, and Breeze, hearing a bustle in the building behind me, snatched up her grey dress and slipped naked into the undergrowth. Yet so strong was my fear of Breeze, and perhaps also my loyalty to her enviable freedom, that I lay howling on the grass with my wrist tucked under my stomach, refusing to say what was the matter. I never saw Breeze again, and nobody ever found out what had become of my gold bracelet. I heard of her further escapades, of course, and would listen with fascinated horror to tales of how she bit a policeman and sent him to hospital for weeks, or how she kicked the matron over, jumped the prison wall, and disappeared into the hills. While I listened to these anecdotes, I would think of Breeze with fond partisanship. After a while, I also became a big girl now, and left the colony for the milder savagery of boarding school. The other day I met an American captain at a cocktail party, and he told me how he had visited my colony just before the war to make watercolour sketches. He told me how, when his ship pulled into the bay, a young woman carrying a tray full of terrible meals and junk, her face powdered till it looked blue and her lips painted purple, stepped up the gangway, and oh boy, what a type! She was a walking tigress. And when she swept off that ship, she took with her the chief petty officer and half a dozen sailors and a bribe of a pound from the purser to clear off and quit making a nuisance of herself, for it seemed that even the local police couldn't keep her in order. Gee, she was a darn beautiful colored woman, and I'd have given a lot to have seen her with her face washed and as nude as a diving boy.
I think if it's okay, we'll move to the clips,
yeah.
Because I've got half an eye on the clock.
Yeah, of course.
Right. Over on my 2 minutes. There'll be a short hiatus while our technical incompetence becomes apparent.